Join me, Dr. Kathy Weston, for my podcast series, Get a Grip, brought to you by Tooled Up Education, the home of evidence-based tips on parenting, family life, and education. In each podcast, I help unpick some of the trickier questions relating to how we raise children today. How do we talk to children about mental health? How can we make sure our children engage safely with the digital world? Whose responsibility is the mental health education of our children, teachers or parents? These podcasts get me talking and you thinking. I've reached out to today's thought leaders and main researchers in this area and asked them their views on the areas where we need to get a grip.
After 2 decades in education, initially working as a teacher, followed by a period in the senior leadership team of an independent school, and more recently holding various roles as an examiner and consultant to a broad spectrum of stakeholders within the education sector, Dr. Erica Gallia has developed a unique ability to reach out to students, educators, parents, and policymakers. With a PhD in psychology and human development from the University College London and a master's in educational leadership with a focus on distributed leadership in Leicester, Erica implements her expertise in this area by acting as an education consultant in quality assurance, as well as coaching and mentoring in educational neuroscience, delivering bespoke workshops tailored to a variety of corporate and educational organisations. Erica has recently founded the Educational Neuroscience Hub in Malta with an aim of creating more awareness and a better understanding of the development of the brain within the context of teaching and learning, both in the school and workplace environments. Good morning, Erica. Thank you so much for joining us this morning to talk about your area of expertise. I'd just like to get started right away because we've got so much to talk about. So for starters, please could you briefly outline exactly what we mean when we talk about emotional regulation, how and when it begins to develop, and what your work with teachers entails?
So emotion regulation is the ability to exert control over one's own emotional state. It involves the effort to modify the emotion felt, either by increasing, maintaining, or decreasing the emotion because it is either ineffective or socially inappropriate. However, this emotion regulation process varies according to individual differences or characteristics, or is influenced by experiences. Emotion regulation is sought to be developed across early childhood and goes on up until adulthood. However, the early years, as we know, are the most crucial years to teach children these emotion regulation skills. Children need a caregiver, be it a parent, teacher, another professional working with children, to model these emotion regulation skills and strategies consistently, predictably, and securely. In view of the fact that the child's prefrontal cortex, which is the frontal lobe, the frontal part of our brain, is not mature yet. Therefore, these young children need external help from an expert who is emotionally regulated to model and practice these emotion regulation strategies. Now, once the parent, the educator, or the caregiver consistently models these strategies, then the child internalizes these emotion regulation strategies, skills, and this results in self-regulation, which involves the control of or the influence of our emotions. For young children or adolescents to learn and internalize these strategies, however, it's important that we co-regulate. Co-regulation is needed. And what is this co-regulation we are mentioning? It is the nurturing relationship. It's the interaction that an adult forms with the learner within a structured and supportive context. Co-regulation can happen amongst the learners themselves, and this is what we call peer regulation. In fact, I observed this during my main data collection in my study. The person co-regulating with the other person must be naturally fully emotionally regulated himself or herself in order to be able to model these emotion regulation strategies to young learners. And learning self-regulation skills through this co-regulation that we're talking about is linked to greater success academically and socially through to adulthood. And this is why caregiving is a fundamental component in children's developing capacities for self-regulation.
Brilliant. Thank you. That's a really detailed answer. And so I know you talked about a range there of ages. So when would you say that we as kind of young babies start to develop those emotional regulation abilities?
They start developing these emotion regulation strategies as they interact with adults. So as these adults are modeling these emotion regulation strategies, then the child from birth starts internalizing these strategies.
Right. So really, really quite early on.
Yes. So I think it's so crucial that the adult needs to be self-regulated him or herself. It's so important.
Yeah. Because like you say, they're modeling then the ability to regulate the emotion for the child who's
That's it.
Brilliant. And I know you've done a lot of work in the education sector, a lot of work with teachers and schools. And could you tell us a little bit about what your work with teachers entails and what that involves?
The teachers, I go into schools and I give workshops. I'm starting to give workshops in the schools as well, and also to students themselves, because I feel that students should be aware of these emotion regulation strategies.
Excellent. Brilliant. Well, I'm sure we'll talk a little bit more about that work and your research as we go through. And can you talk to us a little bit about how emotions are linked to cognitive processes, the development of the kinds of cognitive skills that around play, and why that plays an important role in learning those cognitive skills?
So I believe that both the emotion and cognitive processes equally contribute to the control of thought and behavior. And it is emotion and cognition that work together to activate these particular brain areas and systems and behaviors that seek the adaptable responses to the event. In fact, a key area in the field of education and neuroscience is the interaction between emotion and cognition. It is the interaction of which is essential for the adaptation of the individuals to the environment. In fact, this interaction plays a significant role in the attentional deployment and the processes and regulation of emotional cognition, which are integrated, as we said earlier, very early in development and have a great impact on later development. Emotions serve as an influential medium for increasing or impeding learning. Therefore, they are critical in their academic development. This is so crucial. Emotions are interconnected with the students' academic development and are significant to students' learning outcomes. And emotions, whether positive or negative, exert a powerful influence on these cognitive processes that can affect categorizing, reasoning, logical, and problem-solving skills, and can also affect the attentional and motivational resources available that are needed to engage in these cognitive processes, which we call the executive functions. Now, these executive functions are our higher-order skills, which we call the management system of our brain. And examples of these are, as we mentioned earlier, critical and logical thinking, planning, goal setting, metacognition, amongst many others. So emotion has a huge influence on the student's behavior. And without the regulation of our emotions, our cognitive processes do not function properly. So this is why it is crucial that we regulate our emotions and those of the students.
Brilliant. And I thought it was interesting that you said that kind of the role of positive and negative emotions, because I was going to ask, is it only negative or those more challenging emotions that can impact on cognitive processes? Or do we need to be aware of the impact of both positive and negative emotions on those cognitions?
In fact, we often think that it is negative emotions that may disrupt learning, but it is both negative and positive emotions that hinder students' learning or hinder implementing the task at hand, and also influences the student's executive function found in the prefrontal cortex. In fact, many a times we tend to focus only, as we said, on the negative emotions in the classroom or at home. But it is also positive emotions that hinder learning and attention and focus. Examples of negative emotions in class can be linked to, for instance, anxiety for the upcoming school concert, or stress due to the upcoming exams, anger at a friend for name calling, amongst many other emotionally challenging situations. However, we often ignore the positive emotions too, which also need to be regulated in the classroom because they also hinder learning. And for example, the student's excitement for an upcoming school outing or particular school activities, the anticipation of school holidays or an upcoming school concert, amongst many other situations, can also hinder their focus and attention on learning. So it is crucial to upregulate negative emotions and downregulate positive ones.
That's really interesting, because actually it was funny when you were talking there and I was thinking, I could probably think of about 5 or 6 examples off the top of my head of how negative emotions might impair learning if children are being disruptive. But I was really struggling to think of any positive examples. But you're totally right. Like, if kids are so excited about school holidays or, like you say, a concert, then that's also going to impact on their ability to sit still and listen and learn or hear what the teacher's saying. So
yes, that's
really interesting and really important to be mindful of, like you say, positive and negative emotions. What do we know about the impact of poor emotional regulation on children as they grow? And conversely, what do we know about the benefits of good emotional regulation?
Two big questions, Hope.
Yeah.
So research shows that in educational settings, preschool children with low emotional regulation skills have more conflict with their educators. And poor emotion regulation has detrimental effects on school performance and social relationships. And it may also result in internalizing and externalizing disorders and contribute to societal problems. Even if an adolescent can make positive decisions when calm, those with poor emotion regulation skills will most likely make negative decisions, and these would might involve substance abuse, violence, self-harm, suicidal attempts, and, you know, many other negative decisions that they can take. Integrating knowledge about emotion regulation strategies within the education system, in my opinion, is so crucial to enable a decrease in educational problems such as absenteeism, poor school performance, early school leavers, you know, poor interpersonal skills, and also deficits in higher order cognitive processes. Some of our students may be at risk for emotion regulation related issues, whilst other students may already be displaying behaviors that stem from a deficiency in emotion regulation skills. Now, we have children with inhibited or irritable temperaments may be considered to be more at risk for developing poor emotion regulation. And children who display elevated reactivity to events early in life may also be at risk. And some children's inappropriate emotional responses can inhibit them from making or keeping friendships. And these are both signs of a child having difficulty with emotion regulation. Poor emotion regulation can also manifest in aggressive or explosive behaviors in the classroom. If we regulate our emotions, we do so to effectively manage our well-being, to cope with difficult situations many times throughout each day, and to accomplish our goals and to adapt to the demands of our environment. And we know that emotion regulation is a component of mental health, which encompasses a person's ability to be productive, have a sound interpersonal life, and make positive social relationships. So imagine a child in the classroom with negative thoughts, okay, who is too worried or preoccupied with negative thoughts to pay attention in class, or too reactive to manage frustrations while taking, for example, a maths test, the child's academic performance will most likely suffer. So the ability to properly cope with emotions allows a child to experience an inner sense of calm. So, and even people who are skilled in emotion regulation are typically rated as more socially desirable.
Yeah, so that, I mean, there are some the benefits to good emotional regulation, and as you say, there's a big ripple effect there for poor emotional regulation, especially in terms of an academic or how they are at school, because it just, like you say, it impacts everything in terms of their ability to concentrate or regulate during a test, or and that can have have more severe impacts as you go through. So no, that was really interesting. Thank you. And can you talk us through some of the strategies that you would recommend teachers use in the classroom in order to scaffold children's development of emotional regulation skills? So I know you talked about it being important that we model these things ourselves and help people. If we have got good regulation skills, that can help the child kind of learn. So is there anything that you could talk us through about recommending what teachers would do in a class situation to help scaffold children's emotional regulation abilities?
Yes, in fact, these emotion regulation skills that I'm going to be talking about shortly are valid for anyone from birth up until beyond adulthood. So anyone can use these strategies. In fact, really? The strategies are based on James Gross's process model of emotion regulation, which he published in 1998 and then upgraded in 2015. Mm-hmm. And there are what we call antecedent focused strategies, which are those strategies that are adopted before an emotion occurs. So these strategies are used before the emotion comes about. Mm-hmm. And these strategies are situation selection, situation modification, distraction, and cognitive change. Now I will explain each one in more detail and give an example of each. The first most forward-looking antecedent strategy is situation selection, in which a person chooses to enter into or avoid a situation. However, with regards to this strategy, the boundaries are not always clear and not always an easy task for the children to choose at such a young age. For example, a child does not have the freedom in the classroom to move to a different room to be able to feel better about the situation he or she is in. Therefore, this situation is not encouraged to be modeled in the classroom with the students. So I'm going to focus on the other three emotion regulation strategies. Mm-hmm. So we'll start with situation modification. And this involves modifying a situation to adjust its emotional impact. I will be giving examples of this to be more concrete. An example of situation modification is a group of students are having difficulty working in a group and one child gets particularly angry. And the educator intervenes and defines the roles for each child. Mm-hmm. So with this emotion regulation strategy, the parent or the teacher is physically modifying the situation to make the child feel better. And then we have our next antecedent focus strategy, which is distraction. This is a very popular distraction. We often use it without knowing that we're using an antecedent focus strategy. And this involves redirecting attention away from the situation.
Okay.
An example of a class situation is a child is getting frustrated with covering some written work in class, mm-hmm. and the educator asks him to take a letter to the school secretary's office. So there the teacher took away the student's attention away from the situation. Then we have the last antecedent focus strategy, which is cognitive change via reappraisal, which involves the ability to change how a person looks at a situation or the meaning that they put behind the situation. Mm-hmm. And this is considered to be the most effective strategy. And an example of this is in class, a child is disappointed with his results and his spelling test. The educator explains to the student that he should take this up as an opportunity to learn from his mistakes and that he should study harder next time. And then we have the last emotion regulation strategy, which is not encouraged at all due to the negative impact it has on the teaching and learning process, which is the response focus strategy. But this is adopted after the emotion is generated. When using the response focus strategy, we tend to suppress or conceal our emotions. Mm. And when using suppression, we try to push those emotional thoughts or feelings out of our minds. So here we choose to not indulge in a conscious thought, feeling, or action, even though we are aware of it. So the solution to suppressing emotions, because this can lead to serious psychological conditions if used on a daily basis, is to learn new, healthier ways to regulate our emotions and those of our students. And those are the antecedent focus strategies that we spoke about earlier. the situation modification, cognitive change, and distraction. And once we adopt these strategies, we enhance academic skills of our students, social skills, and even their behavior. So these strategies can be both used at home and at school.
Yeah, I think I love the fact that you were able to give kind of worked examples as well as you went through each of those. And I know you said that the situation modification might be difficult in a classroom versus at home, because obviously at home, the child could maybe take themselves into another room that's quieter or that would make them feel better. And I appreciate in a classroom, that's not possible. But there might be maybe a quiet space or something in a classroom that's kind of designated that a student might be able to go and take themselves off and sit there, that might, it's not completely removing themselves from the situation, yes, but maybe getting them out of their seat. And so, but yeah, the other examples were really, really helpful. So thank you so much for talking us through those. We know that children's capacity to self-regulate does develop over time. And what top tips would you have for teachers when it comes to co-regulating as they scaffold this process?
Now, children, we have to remember that children are not born with these emotion regulation capabilities. We have to keep this in mind. And that their capacity for self-regulation is limited. And this is due to the fact that their prefrontal cortex would not have fully matured yet. Children learn emotion regulation skills through a nurturing relationship, as we mentioned earlier, with a caring teacher or caregiver within a structured and supportive environment in order to learn and practice these new skills. Now, the teacher, through co-regulation, supports and scaffolds the children's thoughts, behavior, and emotion within the occurring situation, adopting these emotion regulation strategies that I explained earlier. Now, co-regulation will look different at different ages as the child's capacity for self-regulation grows. But co-regulation remains a critical resource across development. Now, co-regulation, which I've seen happening too, I've observed happening in my main data collection, can also happen between a more regulated peer who co-regulates with a less regulated peer using these same emotion regulation strategies. And this is what we call peer regulation. And it's also important that the implementation of these emotion regulation strategies is based on Vygotsky's scaffolding. In which the expert, which in this case is either the teacher or a more regulated peer, supports the novice, who is the less regulated child in this case, and builds on the already acquired knowledge or skill level just above where the student currently is until the child is able to self-regulate. So in this perspective, the concept of these interactive supportive processes are built on Vygotsky's notion of the zone of proximal development. Now, during early childhood education, the children at such a young age would need constant repetition, as is done with any other academic skill or sports skill or any other skill in other situations, so that these emotion regulation strategies are internalized and then result in self-regulation. So this would result in the child regulating his or her emotions on his or her own, adopting these same emotion regulation strategies. Now, it is important to note that the capacity for self-regulation develops over time. So it starts from infancy through young adulthood. So the amount of co-regulation a child, youth, or young adult needs will vary as they grow. And as a child's ability to self-regulate increases, less teacher or parent co-regulation is required, naturally. So effective co-regulation, including the presence of a supportive adult in a calm environment, can provide safety and stability for these children, youth or young adults, creating a space where they can begin to learn and enact these self-regulatory skills.
Brilliant. And in terms of, I know you were talking about many influencers, I should say, there, in terms of a caring teacher or a parent or a kind of well-regulated peer as kind of models of good emotional regulation. So would that come into play as well if teachers were to, say, pair up students for like a group task or something? They could all maybe be mindful of pairing up a child that's maybe got poor regulation skills with a kind of a more well-regulated child, and they could learn also some regulation skills from that peer. Would that work?
Yes, that would work. If the teacher decides to use collaborative learning and using group work as a tool in the classroom, yes, that would be a very good strategy to use, so that the more regulated peers would be able to regulate their less regulated peers during the activity, during the task. So
brilliant.
That's a very good idea too.
Yeah, great. No, that's really good. And I like you talking as well about kind of offering space to children, or offering a safe space so that they can try and self-regulate or put some of those strategies into practice. And interestingly, do these strategies vary by cultural context? And if so, how might these strategies need to be adapted in different cultural contexts?
So fundamentally, yes, culture shapes whether individuals are motivated to regulate their emotions. Culture may also shape the adaptiveness of that emotion regulation, that is, whether emotion regulation is good or bad for a person's well-being. And because culture reinforces behaviors that promote culturally supported values, behaviors that are consistent with a culture's values may become more practiced and thus easier to implement and more socially rewarded, both of which may lead to greater well-being. Therefore, emotion regulation may be adaptive when it is consistent with its cultural context and maladaptive when it is inconsistent. For instance, supporting the notion that culturally consistent emotion regulation is more positively valued, Asians, but not Europeans, associate suppression with interpersonal harmony. But on the other hand, Europeans, but not Asians, associate suppression with experiential avoidance. Mm-hmm. So the adult would adopt the emotion regulation strategy best suited within the culture. However, the strategies may change even according to the emotionally challenging situation occurring at that time, at that moment in time, or according to the characteristics of the person, and not only according to cultural contexts. If the teacher or the parent, after trial and error, becomes knowledgeable that one particular emotion regulation strategy works better with one particular student due to the child's characteristics or due to that occurring situation, and realize that the strategy has had a positive impact in the past, in past emotion eliciting situations, then the teacher or that parent would keep on adopting that specific emotion regulation strategy.
Brilliant. I feel like that's quite a nice, empowering message for teachers and for parents, because they'll know their child or their students best. So like you say, they'll know if a particular strategy is working best in that particular situation for that child, which I think is a nice, empowering message for teachers and parents. And I know that you recently spoke at a European conference on how educators can regulate children's emotions through classroom games. I think you were examining the fact that games and artificial intelligence can be useful teaching tools that present both opportunities and difficulties in the classroom. And one of the challenges is the presence of a child's anxiety or panic and assessment-induced stress during game-based learning. So can you tell us a little bit about this and maybe provide some examples for us as well?
Yes, I learned a lot from the conference. In fact, just finished a few days ago.
Oh, wow.
Yes, it was all about digital game-based learning. Now, this digital game-based learning, which is advancing at a very fast rate, in class, for example, many teachers use Kahoot, Quizzes, Mentimeter, or Quizlet. These are different apps that teachers use. But there's also much more than this. There's also Minecraft, blocks, and many others that they can use in the classroom. So this digital game-based learning is an active learning technique that uses games to improve student learning. It also promotes critical thinking and problem-solving skills, as well as allows students to experience the learning firsthand and also think outside the box. Mm-hmm. However, there are some elements of gamification that can cause this anxiety, frustration, panic, and also can induce stress during the teaching and learning process. We are aware that anxiety can impact the overall performance and persistence during the teaching and learning. Mm-hmm. As an emotional state, anxiety can be experienced by students when they are worried about failure, as we know, and mm-hmm. are unable to assert control over the outcome. And this can be felt by many students during competitive game-based learning. We mentioned gamification elements earlier. So what are these gamification elements? Examples of these are the assignment of points or badges according to how well the player is performing, timers. Okay. There are many apps that have a timer going on, which makes the student feel anxious. Leaderboards, this is the display of the ranking of the leaders in a competitive event. Other examples are leveling systems, challenges, or the decisions that the students come across or have to make to go up to the next level. Scores and rewards are also included. Now, all these elements, game-based elements, can place a student under pressure to perform well or due to the fact that they are being timed. And these can make students feel anxious and present assessment-like stress because students feel that they are being assessed or examined under these conditions. However, these emotion regulation strategies that we described earlier can help in reducing this anxiety or stress in order to perform well.
Brilliant. No, I think that's good and good for teachers to be aware of, like you say, you know, the artificial intelligence or kind of game-based apps are being used at a much growing rate in the classroom. So I think these are really important things for teachers to be aware of, especially, you know, I'm not a teacher, but I wouldn't have thought maybe timers or things, leaderboards or rankings would maybe induce that much stress. But it's really good information to know that actually those things can induce that same assessment level of stress in children, which might impact their behavior or their emotional regulation abilities. And do you have any advice for parents in terms of, I know we've talked a lot about from a very young age, children are going to start to use their parents and then other people in their environment around them to help scaffold and support their emotional regulation development. So do you have any advice for parents in terms of promoting emotional literacy at home? Perhaps this will change varying depending on the age and stage of the child, but do you have any advice for parents about promoting emotional literacy in the house?
Oh, yes, I do. I find it so crucial to promote emotion and literacy because then eventually it would help the children regulate their own emotions, express what they're feeling, and then eventually regulate their emotions. So first, parents and teachers need to be aware of the child's emotions, see emotions as an opportunity for connection and teaching, mm-hmm. and listen and validate those feelings. We need to allow the children to express themselves in whatever situation they find themselves in. Do not shut them up and tell them to grow up. We have a habit of doing this.
Yeah.
And that suppression, we're suppressing the children's emotions when we say, you need to grow up. Let's listen to our children and to the emotions they are feeling. Mm-hmm. We can also prompt them to assist them in expressing themselves, and we may also help them label their emotions for them. We can use games to explore emotions or to help them express themselves, give them the tools for managing emotions. And we can also use books and TV to help them understand others. Ask questions to teach empathy. Show empathy in your own actions and stay calm and practice self-care. And it is also important that we, as we mentioned earlier, we have to model the emotion regulation strategies. Because adopting these emotion regulation strategies also helps build emotional intelligence and resilience, because we help them reach self-regulation of emotions. This way, they are able to face any life stresses or any problems they come across in life and will definitely become more resilient. And this is what we want the younger generations to be, resilient and emotionally regulated. And all this can be done at different ages and stages of the children's life.
Excellent. Well, those are some really brilliant tips and advice. And I think even anecdotally, I know a few of my friends that are parents are, you're very quick to say, like, come on, grow up, act your age.
Yes, we have a habit of doing this.
Yeah, exactly. But it's good to know that actually, like you say, you maybe let's take a step back. It's hard, I suppose, in that situation if you're frustrated as well. But a good time to try and regulate your own emotions and kind of model that for your child. And how important is it to boost our child's emotional vocabulary? So I know you were talking there about labeling emotions and helping children understand what they're feeling and giving that a label and a name. So how important is it to boost our child's emotional vocabulary?
Building a child's emotional vocabulary is very crucial indeed. A large and more complex emotion vocabulary allows children to make finer discriminations between feelings, to better communicate with others about their internal affective states, and to engage in discussions about their personal experiences with the world. It also helps the children identify and communicate different types of feelings, which in turn helps them manage emotions in productive ways instead of hitting or acting out or withdrawing. And this development of emotion vocabulary influences a child's self-confidence, empathy, the ability to develop meaningful and lasting friendships and partnerships, and most crucially, a sense of importance and value to those around him or her. Now, once the children are able to express how they are feeling and express which emotional state they are in, it is easier for the teacher or the parent to regulate their emotions and easier to choose the appropriate emotion regulation strategy. And we could do this by introducing an emotion chart in the classroom or at home, displaying different emotions in the form of emojis with the word representing that emoji beneath it. I'm trying to be very concrete here to help parents and teachers. And on a daily basis, we could ask each child to express how they are feeling by choosing the correct emoji and placing it near their name or placing their name next to the emoji on the emotion chart. And as the child chooses the emoji, the parent or teacher discusses that emotion with the child and asks why the child is feeling that way. These are a few examples of how we can promote the emotion vocabulary in class and at home. In fact, during my university courses with the prospective teachers I lecture, I give a lot of examples. I encourage this emotion chart, you know, as they enter the classroom. Teachers ask them how they're feeling today. And, you know, the teachers can gauge what mood they're in or what emotion they are currently feeling on that particular day.
Yeah, which I think can be, or I imagine must be really helpful for teachers, or it would be, because they're already aware maybe if a child's feeling anxious or upset, or maybe something happened on the drive to school, or, you know, I think that can really help prepare teachers for maybe what's to come that day, or to try and put in place some of the strategies that you've talked about through the podcast to try and help that child regulate their emotions before it impacts their learning or ability to take on instructions or tasks for the rest of the day. So I really love that idea of the emotional chart with the emojis.
I think I've seen it working in the classroom on my visits with the prospective teachers in the classroom, and it's amazing how they learn how to express themselves. If we don't teach these children how to express themselves, they won't be able to let you know how they're feeling.
Yeah.
So we need to practice that emotion vocabulary on a daily basis so that they'll be able to express themselves, and in turn, the teacher or the parent would find it easier to regulate their emotions.
Yeah. And what a great example as well to give, that it's something that teachers can integrate into their practice that they're doing on a daily basis anyway. Because I think I know from some work I had previously done with teachers, I think they're trying their best, but they've not got a lot of additional time to be doing lots of other things. So like you say, if it's something that they can do at the start of the day on a daily basis, they children know it's going to be a routine where they talk about how they're feeling and can place their name next to the emoji or the emoji next to their name. I think that's a great example that teachers can integrate that into their daily practice. And I know that we're talking here and under the assumption that maybe teachers and parents are good themselves at regulating their own emotions and are good at doing that. But what would happen in a case where perhaps the adults are finding it quite hard to regulate their own emotions? Do you have any advice for adults who might find emotional regulation quite challenging, and then how they teach a child how to regulate their emotions if they themselves aren't feeling very confident about doing it?
Yes, in fact, I think it's the first. We cannot regulate others' emotions if our emotions are not regulated. Mm-hmm. Emotion regulation, as I mentioned before, is not a skill we are born with. So yes. Children's moods can swing like a pendulum, you know, in 1 minute they're fine, the other they're in a tantrum.
Yeah.
Experienced that with my own children. So helping our children to self-regulate a wide range of emotions is among both parents and teachers' most important tasks. However, us adults need to be self-regulated to be able to regulate our students' or children's emotions. If parents indulge in throwing their own tantrums, so will their children. Mm-hmm. So if we can stay calm, they learn that it's not actually an emergency when they get upset, and they learn to calm themselves. Mm-hmm. As mentioned earlier, modeling has long been recognized as a crucial mechanism through which children learn. And this we mentioned through co-regulation. Children observe their parents' every move, and it's not only the parents, but also their teachers in the classroom. They internalize and then mimic these behaviors. The behaviors of the parents or the children. Their parents and the teacher's own ability to practice self-regulation is among the first emotion-related modeling children see, as you know, from birth. Children learn the correct reaction in different situations. They watch how parents and teachers control and struggle with intense emotions and impulses. In fact, research shows that children of parents who struggle with emotional regulation are more likely to end up having dysregulation, which refers to the instability of emotions. Mm-hmm. So if a parent is reactive, screams or yells whenever something goes wrong, the child learns to be reactive and misbehave when things don't go their way. If a parent is calm, on the other hand, and thinks critically to solve problems, then the child is more likely to stay calm and look for solutions instead of blame. Mm-hmm. And the younger the child, the stronger this imitation effect. And besides active observation, children also learn through emotional contagion. And this is when children unconsciously sense their parents' emotions and respond with similar feelings. For example, when parents frown, raise their voices, or make angry gestures, children become angry too. Mm-hmm. So that's emotion contagion. And when parents raise their voices, children also increase their volume. So parental or teacher modeling is the number one way to teach children self-regulation. Emotion regulation in children comes from emotion regulation in the parents. And I really think we need to remember this. There are emotion regulation activities or tools geared towards children that could supplement, you know, can be used as a supplement or last resort for children who don't have a good role model for them. We also know that peer influence also, as they grow older, there's also peer influence besides parental influence. But in my opinion, you know, modeling, I think, is the best way forward, you know, to teach children how to regulate. Even if I'm conversing with another adult and children are in the same room, I think it's so important that, and we're having an argument with that person, that is also a time for modeling. Yeah. Children are constantly observing us, you know, and internalizing our behaviors, you know?
Yeah, definitely. So like you say, it doesn't even have to be just in the interactions with your child or your student that you're modeling that behavior. You need to be modeling it when you're, like you say, you're conversing with another adult, if you're having a disagreement, or, you know, modeling the same kind of behavior that you would if you were talking to a child.
If we end up suppressing our feelings, we're showing children that we're suppressing our feelings, and that's what they're going to do. So So yeah. Whatever we model, they're going to learn.
Yeah.
And we need to keep this in mind, both parents and teachers.
Brilliant. No, that's a really good, a really powerful message. And I know that you mentioned there that there were some resources that are specifically for children that can be used to help with emotion regulation. And are there any other specific resources that you would recommend for teachers or for parents that are wanting to scaffold their child's self-regulation skills?
I think the most practical resource, as I mentioned earlier, is the emotion chart. It's practical, you know, you hang it somewhere in the classroom or at home, and you can use it as a tool to promote emotion vocabulary and literacy. And once the child is aware of his or her emotions, it is easier for that child to express and regulate their emotions. And definitely the use of the antecedent focus strategies through modeling, as we mentioned, and those are distraction, cognitive change, and situation modification, but very important to be based on a scaffolding technique, which involves teaching a child something new by building on what they already know or can do. So every time the same situation occurs, we don't start from zero, you know, we don't start all over, but we build on what we've started earlier. And we try our best to avoid suppressing our children's emotions. Because if we suppress, that behavior is going to recur. And we need to keep in mind that we need to tackle the emotion and not the behavior, because it is the emotion. The behavior is a result of the emotion. Yeah. So if we're going to tackle the behavior is going to recur. Why? Mm-hmm. Because if we're tackling behavior, we are automatically suppressing. But if we tackle the emotion and not the behavior, then we are regulating the children's emotions.
Yeah, brilliant. I think that's also a really important key message, because I think a lot of the time, especially with younger children, it's so easy to get caught up in the behavior, or get sucked into the behavior because it's happening right then and there. But like you say, actually, if we look what's going on underneath that, it is the emotion that's underlying it. So yeah, I think that's an important message for parents and teachers. And what exciting projects are you working on at the moment, Erica? What are you busy with at the moment?
Post my PhD.
Yeah, there's no rest.
Work has increased immensely.
Yeah.
So I'm currently delivering workshops on emotional intelligence and a variety of other crucial areas in education and neuroscience, such as neurodiversity, neuromyths, metacognition, and other areas. And I'm offering these workshops to school staff, including teachers, senior leadership teams, teaching assistants, as well as other educational agencies and other professionals who work with children or teenagers, both locally and on an international basis too. So not only based in Malta. In addition, I'm also providing these workshops for parents, which I think is so crucial, because when working together, parents and teachers, in my opinion, have a larger developmental impact on our students. So when the stakeholders are working together, I think, you know, it would result in a positive impact on our learners. I'm also publishing articles from my doctoral research study related on emotion regulation, as well as co-authoring a book which includes discussing different strategies based on educational neuroscience that an educator can choose to adopt in the classroom. An exciting Erasmus project coming up in the pipeline to bring AI, artificial intelligence, game-based learning, STEAM, and education neuroscience together.
Wow.
And apart from all this, I also part-time lecture in the science of teaching and learning at the University of Malta. And I offer education and consultancy in quality assurance in various schools, besides keeping up my own blog on a bi-weekly basis, where parents and educators can sort of read or listen to vlogs with different education and neuroscientists around the world, you know, about different strategies that we can use both at home and also in the classroom. So there's a lot going on.
Yeah, definitely.
I love what I do, hope. I got a passion for education and everything that goes with it.
No, I can definitely tell. And sorry, I should have said at the start, congratulations on recently achieving your PhD. That's fantastic.
Thank you.
And yeah, it sounds like you're extremely busy doing lots of stuff. I feel like, yeah, it's that old adage, isn't it? If you love what you do, you're not really working. So yeah, I think that's brilliant. And it's like so many good things that perhaps we can point parents or teachers to when we publish the podcast as well. So yeah.
Thank you. I wanted to thank you, Hope, for this. It's emotion regulation is so important. Emotion and intelligence in general is so important, especially after the pandemic.
Yeah, you know, definitely.
We're seeing a high rate of anxiety and depression in young children as well in schools, you know. So yeah. I think it's a crucial area.
Yeah, definitely. No, I thank you for your time and talking to us and really highlighting these key important messages around emotional regulation. It's been really lovely to speak to you today.
Thank you, Rob.
Thank you.
This Get a Grip podcast is brought to you by Tooled Up Education, the home of evidence-based tips on parenting, family life and education. www.tooledupeducation.com. Parents and teachers in Tooled Up schools can also access notes accompanying each podcast, available to read and download from the Tooled Up site.